Meanwhile, here on BBC Radio 4 FM, our new book of the week, Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography. Author Meryl Sechrest examines the life of one of the most extraordinary designers of the 20th century, despite being Chanel's biggest rival and combining the worlds of art and fashion. Her story has been much less well documented. The reader is Abigail Thor.
When Elsa Schiaparelli wrote her memoir in 1954, she called it Shocking Life. By then, she was well known for her promotional skills, so it is impossible to know how much actually happened. One incident, however, turns up much later in Salvador Dali's imagery. Elsa relates that, as a little girl, convinced of her ugliness, she had a moment of inspiration. Flowers were beautiful, so she would plant them in her ears, down her throat, and into her nose. They would grow and cover her face, and then she would be beautiful. She writes that it took two doctors and seven attempts to remove the seeds, and in particular, a hardened plug of cotton wool that she had jammed up her nose. This kind of detail would suggest that the event really happened. Schiaparelli writes that she is constantly compared unfavourably with her elder sister Beatrice. She is too thin. She is difficult. As an adult, she looks dispassionately at a photograph of herself as if it was someone else and writes, "Schiap," as she referred to herself, "was an ugly child. She had enormous eyes and looked half-starved." However, a photograph taken when she was 4 or 5 shows a little girl with short black hair and a fringe, her head tilted to one side with lustrous eyes and delicate, even features. She records that when she was born, in 1890, her parents planned for a boy and did not know what to do with a girl. They had no names for her. At her christening, driven to make a choice, and finding that the name of their baby's nurse was Elsa, they used that. As she grew older, the French term jolie laide, not pretty but not plain either, would have fitted her. Her nose and upper lip were a trifle too long, her mouth a little too wide, and her chin a little too firmly set for conventional prettiness. In addition, she had 7 moles on her left cheek and down her chin that she was self-conscious about. She was no more than 5 feet tall, with a small-boned, trim figure. Her account of her years at school gives the strong impression that she was marking time, waiting for real life to begin. Girls of her class were prepared for marriage as they had been for centuries, so Elsa learned languages, went to parties, made friends in the right circles, and developed the arts of conversation in French, English, and German. In 1913, a family friend offered her a position helping to care for orphaned children in an English country house. She jumped at the chance of leaving home and went to London by train, breaking her journey in Paris for a few days. As soon as she saw Paris, she told herself, "This is the place where I am going to live." By chance, she met a family friend who was living there, Alberto Lambroso. He had been invited to a ball. Would she like to join him? Elsa Schiaparelli, who never turned down a party in her life, certainly would. But she had nothing to wear. Elsa had arrived in Paris at a pivotal moment. For decades, women had been wearing full-length skirts and tiers of petticoats, corsets that tortured and deformed their bodies, upswept hairstyles, and monstrous hats that ripped away in the least wind. But the great couturier Paul Poiret had abandoned the corset for a more natural shape. Such a radically new look depended upon skillful drapery. So Elsa went to the Galerie Lafayette and bought 4 yards of a heavy dark blue crepe de chine and 2 yards of orange silk. Then she began to invent her dress. She found a way to keep the blue crepe in place by draping it around her body and passing it between her legs, keeping the fabric in place with pins. The orange silk became a sash and a turban. Off she went to the ball. She wrote, "In a way, Schiap was a small sensation. Nobody had ever seen anybody dressed in such a queer way." During an especially lively tango, The pins holding everything together began to loosen and scatter on the dance floor. With great presence of mind, her partner steered her off the floor and out of the room before the costume disintegrated altogether. After a while, the job in the countryside came to an end, and Elsa found herself in London. It never occurred to her to go home to Italy. She wrote, "I was not very close to my family." Return would have meant doors closing. She also liked London. One evening, she decided to go to a lecture on theosophy, the philosophical belief with ancient roots. It was being given by a quite unknown man who was rather handsome in a queer way. He was talking about the powers of the soul over the body, of magic and eternal youth. She listened, spellbound. After the audience left, she was still sitting in her chair. Pretty soon, she and the lecturer were talking. They spent a whole night discovering what appeared to be a complete communion of ideas. They were engaged the next morning, just like that. Her alarmed parents raced to London to stop the marriage, but it was too late. Wilhelm de Wendt de Kerlaw, age 30, and Elsa Luisa Maria Schiaparelli, 23, were married in the Register Office, St. Martin's District, London, on July 21st, 1914. By the time Elsa had met him, de Kerlaw had acquired a certain expertise as a lecturer and author on the paranormal and had established an occult library at No. 1 Piccadilly Place. His address was certainly Piccadilly, but although the telephone exchange was Mayfair, this was an alley in the Down Market area near Piccadilly Circus. De Kerlaw must have seemed like the professorial, scholarly-minded father and uncles she grew up with, and his title of consulting psychologist had a ring to it. In fact, he read palms for half a guinea and made predictions. This was against the law, and he received a caution from the police. The Vagrancy Act of 1824 made it illegal for every person professing to tell fortunes to deceive any of His Majesty's subjects. He was, he said, much talked about in the British press. They called him the Piccadilly Fakir. In the spring of 1915, de Kerlaw was sentenced to deportation under the Vagrancy Act for being a rogue and a vagabond by pretending to tell fortunes. He and Elsa had the weekend to pack and left England. A year after marrying the man of her dreams, she was now sharing in his humiliating fate. Paris would seem to be the obvious destination, but they were not going there. From the day war was declared, Paris was in immediate danger from the Germans. The best solution, de Kerlaw reasoned, was to go to his parents in Cannes, about as far away from the fighting as they could get. A certain flatness of tone pervades Schiaparelli's account of their stay while they were awaiting the announcement of an armistice that might or might not appear. No doubt de Kerlaw was optimistically predicting its arrival every 6 months. Elsa liked their small apartment near the sea. It was peaceful, but soon de Kerlaw decided that America was the place to go. He adroitly changed his name to de Kerloff and became a Russian, presumably because Russia was then fighting with the Allies, ensuring a friendly reception when he appeared on American shores. They crossed the Atlantic on the SS Chicago, a passenger liner built to ferry Europeans from Le Havre to New York, most of them immigrants. By the autumn of 1917, Willie and Elsa had taken office space in rooms on Fifth Avenue and opened their Bureau of Psychology. The fact that she was closely involved in her husband's activities is nowhere mentioned in her memoir, but much of the work required, writing letters, making dates, creating publicity, must have fallen to her. As the First World War shuddered to a halt, Willie and Elsa zigzagged from one harebrained scheme to another and in and out of New York apartments with bewildering speed. Over time, the beliefs they passionately shared, spiritism, alchemy, and the occult, had been tested, as one by one, his claims proved to be bogus. He was a fraud. After 5 years of marriage, they were growing apart, but in the autumn of 1919, Elsa became pregnant. The idea of bringing up a baby certainly did not fit in with Willie's plans. The baby girl, Maria Luisa, was born on June the 15th, 1920, and Willie moved out a matter of weeks after her birth. Elsa appears to have made no effort to track down her husband for financial help. She was a single mother now, and her situation brought out the side of her that rose to any challenge. The baby lacked a bed, and she could not pay for one. She would put her in an orange crate. Hotels were turning her away because they did not want a single woman with an infant. She would leave the baby in the taxi and get the room first. The baby screamed all night, and she was about to be evicted. When the manager arrived at her door, "Never have I tried harder to seduce a man, and never for such a good cause. At last I succeeded." She would put her endearing, laughing child, who never minded being alone, on the fire escape to sleep in the sunshine while she went job hunting. The next few months are a jumble of efforts at partial solutions for the baby. There was a country house that took in children, so Elsa left her there. She visited in December and found her daughter, now 6 months old, parked on a terrace and freezing cold. Elsa found a job with a Wall Street broker, watching the ticker tape, getting all the numbers wrong, and was fired. She discovered a nice old nurse in the Connecticut countryside and left the baby with her. Now there was some money from Italy, and she moved to a room in Patchin Place that was so small she had to sit on the bed to dress. But then the money was gone, and she was always hungry. Elsa explains her daughter's nickname of Gogo by saying that she made constant gurgling sounds to that effect. But her daughter's explanation sounds more likely. Gogo said, "A mad socializer, Mummy got all dressed up every night for her umpteen dinner parties, leaving me with a nanny. Dashing out of the door, she would always call to me, 'Well, I must go now,' and I would look up and say, 'Go, go, going, go, go.' So I was called Gogo, and it stuck." At 15 months, Gogo was not walking properly. Elsa consulted a specialist and learned that Gogo had infantile paralysis, or polio. "I spent my early years in plaster casts, on and off crutches. I could ski before I could walk. As for her mother, I barely saw her. A lot of my childhood was spent alone and parentless." In 1921, Elsa met Mario Laurenti, who was singing small roles at the Metropolitan Opera. She fell in love with her usual impetuousness. She wrote, "We found in each other much peace and happiness." Laurenti went on a concert tour in upstate New York early the following year, and Elsa went with him. He developed an abscess in his ear. Alarmed, they went back to New York, where he immediately underwent an operation. But it was too late. The abscess had become spinal meningitis, and he died a day later. It is hard to overestimate the effect of the sudden death of someone in whom Elsa Schiaparelli had placed so many hopes. "Like Job, I reeled under the blow," she wrote. "What had I done to deserve this?"
Abigail Thor was reading from Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Sechrist. It's abridged by Libby Sparia, produced by Joanna Green, and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. You can hear the next episode at the same time tomorrow. The singer Kaiser talks to Jane Garvey about her latest hit, Hideaway, that's on Woman's Hour. It's coming up in a couple minutes after the BBC News. Now, though, let's look ahead to next week.
We've never been in circumstances like this, not just in our lifetime, but ever.
For BBC Radio 4, the historian Peter Hennessy considers the impact of changing the way the United Kingdom is governed.
Under the devolution settlement, if things go wrong between the constituent parliaments, it is the Supreme Court that will have to act as the arbiter. And does that mean there's a danger of the judges right at the top being politicised?
He talks to senior figures in public life in a series of one-to-one conversations.
Do we sculpt out of the existing House of Commons a system for creating a surrogate English parliament? How do we do that?
The Kingdom to Come, next Monday to Friday at 9:45 in the morning, and then on the Radio 4 website.